Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw bricks through that Starbucks window, you left me all alone, all alone. In awe at the red, white, and blue on the 4th of July. While those fireworks were exploding, I was burning, that swinging my black flag high, eating the peanuts that the parties have tossed you. In the backseat of your father's new Ford, you believe in the ballot, you believe in reform. You have faith in the elephant and jackass, and to you, solidarity's a four-letter word. We're all hypocrites, but you're a patriot. You thought I was only joking when I screamed kill Whitey at the top of my lungs, at the cops in their cars and the men in their suits. No, I won't take your hand and marry the state. Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw bricks through that Starbucks window, you left me all alone, all alone.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Circle Day Show. As you hear this, it's broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. However, we are pre-recording the interview at the Guardian headquarters in King's Cross. The reason being, I fancy a change of scenery, and our interviewee, Rob Evans, is an author and reporter for The Guardian. Today we are going to be discussing his book, co-authored with Paul Lewis, called Undercover, The True Story of Britain's Secret Police. Very chilling stuff, I must say. Lovely to meet you, Rob.
Thank you very much.
Hello. And I must say as well that both me and Janie, who present the presents the show, The Circle Day, once a month. You obviously will know that if you listen. And she's going to help me out with the interview, just so we can cover as much as possible and take advantage of our time here.
Do you believe that current undercover officers are abstaining from sexual relationships in the field?
I've no idea. I mean, the undercover, well, the first question is, are there undercover officers still out there? And I think that the answer to that question is yes. I think that the problem that the police have at the moment is that before Mark Kennedy, the campaigners who were being infiltrated would perhaps be suspicious of people, but they were much less knowledgeable about what the possible infiltration could be. So now there's a lot more information out there. The activists know as well some of the techniques, some of the things to look for.
We're hopefully adding to that resource right now.
So the problem is any undercover officer has got a greater fear that they could be found out. So, but on the other hand, what the police can't do is, you know, when Mark Kennedy came up, was exposed, they couldn't suddenly just withdraw all the undercover officers, because, you know, then it looks, if someone suddenly disappears from the scene, it looks very obvious.
Yeah.
So I think the police now have got, you know, it's because the activists have been canny in unmasking the infiltrators. The police have that's made it more difficult for the police. And what I think that what this game is often about is a sort of, you know, it's a fluid game of offense defense. So the activists do this, the police react in this way. The police, you know, activists find out this is a technique that the police have got. The police have got to change that technique. So it's a constant game that's going on.
Cat and mouse, a little bit.
Yeah, it's a game of wits, really.
Yeah. In the book, you write about suspected infiltrator Rod Richardson. Mm. How did he turn up on your radar? And can you tell us more about why the known images of him remain unpublished?
Rod Richardson, again, I mean, Rod Richardson, who I must stress is a suspected infiltrator, came, I mean, again, this is another example in which the campaigners themselves who were infiltrated came forward with information about Rod Richardson. And the interesting thing about Rod Richardson is that why they were often campaigners, you know, activists are sort of suspicious about people. I mean, this has gone on for years and years. But actually proving someone is a bit, an infiltrator is another matter. But I think what's interesting is that, of course, people, the activists have found out that, you know, about the technique that the police were using on the use of the dead children. So obviously what they can now do is they can go and check in their records that person, did they really exist? Did the person they think was an infiltrator, did that person die? Because they can go and check the, if they know the person's birth date, they can go and check to see if that individual died. You can do that in a matter of seconds now on the internet. So what's interesting in this case is that, of course, someone went and people were suspicious about Rod Richardson, the person known as Rod Richardson, and went and checked and found that the date that Rod Richardson, the person who said he was Rod Richardson, gave for his birth date, actually, that individual had died as a baby after 2 days. So obviously, the person who says he's Rod Richardson
cannot be
Rod Richardson. Who he is another matter. But I mean, looking at the evidence, he would have a lot of questions to answer if he suddenly appeared. But can I just say that I do think there is certainly one picture of Rod Richardson out there. I think there's two.
Wearing the mask. It's because I read on an anarchist blog that apparently there's four pictures, but only two have been published, and there was two unpublished.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a memory that we published.
You've got one in the book.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely one of him masked up in Genoa, actually, in 2001,
yeah.
I think it is. I've got a feeling that there's another one out there. I mean, yes.
Okay. In the book, you write about an officer, Mike Chitty, alias Mike Blake. There is some suggestion that he turned while he was undercover, developing greater sympathy for his targets and adopted causes than his police superiors. The possibility of turning has been hotly debated since Mark Kennedy insinuated he had gone the same way. Do you think, having interviewed people, that this is a realistic suggestion?
Well, yes, that's a complex question. Let's take Mark Kennedy first of all.
Yeah.
I don't think Mark Kennedy ever did turn.
Yeah.
Mark Kennedy, there's a very great deal of difference between Mark Kennedy and Peter Francis. Peter Francis went undercover, developed doubts about what he was doing, came to us and has talked about what he did and has given an account, a full account of what he did. Mark Kennedy never did that. Mark Kennedy has never told the people he infiltrated, and includes in that all the women he slept with, he has never given a truthful account of what he did. So while Mark Kennedy might say, oh yes, I had sympathy with the activists and I loved them, they loved me, we must remember that he never actually came forward and told the truth about what he did.
Yeah, he seems quite a strange guy because he was interviewed wearing an ACAB. For our listeners, all coppers are bastards. I think they mostly know that. But wearing an ACAB T-shirt, but he seemed to be mostly interested in protecting his own psychiatric health and his own idea of himself as a good guy, rather than, as you say, with Peter Francis, behaving as a whistleblower.
Yes, I mean, Mark Kennedy is not a whistleblower. Mark is someone, I mean, in one sense, he I mean, it was quite interesting. In Channel 4, soon after he was unmasked, he agreed to be on a documentary for Channel 4, of which he was paid to appear. And it was very much his side of things. I always thought that was a very sort of unenlightening and uninvolving documentary, because he never really said the truth. And, you know, I was reading it, funnily enough, I was reading a review of it the other day in The Guardian, and it said, you know, Mark Kennedy appears to try to make out that he's more sinned against than sinning.
Yeah, it's an emotional narrative rather than an expose. And I know it's called The Secret Life of an Undercover Policeman. Is that the name?
That's right, which it isn't, actually.
Yeah.
Because it's not, you know, it's not telling the truth. And, I mean, undoubtedly, Mark Kennedy, I think, it has got conflicting emotions and loyalties. And he's now suing the police for psychiatric damage to his health, which I think is probably true, actually, and he should probably get a payout on it. So he is again someone who I wouldn't classify as someone who's come out and told the truth. I think it's very interesting, actually. If you go back to the thing that always goes through my mind is, you know, what happened after the apartheid regime was abolished. And, you know, there were a lot of informants, there's a lot of bad behaviour by the police. But what's interesting there was that the idea of truth and reconciliation, the people come forward and tell the truth, and they, you know, these different people, there's a reconciliation. I don't think we've got anywhere near that with Mark Kennedy.
Mm. The book was great at showing how institutional racism is still alive and kicking within the police force and higher up the chain of command. The Stephen Lawrence case was an ample example of this. Could you say more about how an undercover was deployed to infiltrate the grieving family? What was the police's intention and the deployment of Pete Black, a.k.a. Peter Francis?
Yes, I mean, what the police have admitted so far is that a number of undercover officers were deployed into the campaigns to that were putting the police under pressure over the Stephen Lawrence issue. And these were, I mean, Peter Francis was deployed into a group known as Youth Against Racism in Europe. And the big issue at that time was the death of Stephen Lawrence. And the police wanted to know what the campaigners were up to, really, because they were getting a lot of heat from, you know, the family, from the campaign, because they had bungled this investigation through their own racism. And the family and their supporters were saying simply, look, you know, someone has died here. There ought to be a proper investigation into his murder. And from that, there was a lot of political pressure. There's a lot of demonstrations going on. And the police deployed undercover officers to find out, you know, exactly what was going on there.
In the letter the Metropolitan Police wrote to Peter Francis, alias Pete Black, Francis is told he can't be offered any immunity for breaching the Official Secrets Act. But the letter then goes on to say, I have made the decision at this time to treat you as a witness and hope that you are prepared to assist the inquiry. Could you elaborate on exactly what this leaves him free to say or what the meaning of it might be? It sounds kind of like a threat, I have to say.
Right. I mean, Peter Francis was retired from the Metropolitan Police in 2001, and he was retired because he'd suffered psychological damage from his undercover deployment. And, you know, he suffered from the pressure of being undercover and also the confusion of having two identities. Now, he was the first undercover officer in that unit, in that operation to actually sue the police and take legal action to the police, very simply, on a very simple principle, that they had caused him damage, and they ought to A, admit that, and B, pay some sort of compensation. So he was in a battle with the police, a legal battle that went on for 5 years, very grueling. And Peter says that, you know, there are a number of occasions where he was threatened with the threatened by the police. You know, don't ever think of going to the press. Don't speak out, or, you know, remember the Official Secrets Act. Remember that you could be prosecuted. So this happened on a number of occasions. So he's saying to the police, you know, if how can I come and talk to you with this threat still hanging over me? And he wants a very clear signal from the police that they will not investigate him over the Official Secrets Act.
Which, based on the question, they are not prepared to do at this present time.
No. But again, there's a bigger question there as well about trust in the police. Do we trust the police to investigate themselves?
No. No way.
It's the personal opinion of this show.
So then again, it all comes back to the same thing. Does Peter, you know, can we trust the police to investigate what Peter is saying and treat it seriously and actually do it in a credible way?
That was a rhetorical question, wasn't it, that you gave it?
yes. this is a question for the public.
Yes, yeah, fair enough.
But it's a big question that's running through a lot of, you know, that this has gone on for years and years. Do we trust the police to investigate themselves? Why do we have the Independent Police Complaints Commission? That was the solution that was meant to rectify.
Your research led you to believe that Bob Lambert, alias Bob Robinson, planted a bomb in the Harrow branch of Debenhams. Do you think anything will be done about this? Like, evident? Well, I don't know what the word is.
Can I say straight away?
Allegations. Can I just say,
did your research lead you?
That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, can I just say that very clearly that the allegation has been made in Parliament by an MP that Bob Lambert planted a bomb. It's not a bomb, actually. It's an incendiary device. I mean, it's a very interesting question, this, actually, because what was happening was that in the mid-80s, the animal rights movement was quite vigorous. And one thing they were doing was they were campaigning against the fur trade. And some of them had clearly, some of the activists were clearly laying incendiary devices in big stores that were selling fur, in order to set fire to the stores, in order to put pressure on them to stop selling fur. And Bob Lambert was deployed to find out, he was deployed in that area, and one of the things that he was tasked to do was to find out who these people were and to stop them. And actually it shows the skill of Bob Lambert that, he got very close to one of the main activists, to activists who were doing this. Now, the question for the police is always a difficult one, which runs through all undercover operations. In order to be a credible part of the conspiracy, you've got the infiltrator has got to build up their own credibility and therefore take part in, you know, the alleged crime. So the question is, how far in this case did Bob Lambert go? And last year, an MP stood up in the Houses of Parliament and said that Bob Lambert had actually placed, there had been three incendiary...
Was that Caroline Lucas?
Yes, Caroline Lucas, who the only Green MP, got up and said in Parliament, said that there were... On this one occasion, there were three incendiary devices set off in Debenham stores. Two culprits were were found and convicted, put away. But the third one got away scot-free. And the one of the activists who was convicted has alleged that the actual person who did this, the third part of their conspiracy was Bob Lambert. What's interesting about this is that Bob Lambert undoubtedly knew Jeff Shepherd, the activist. What the investigation that the police are carrying out is, you know, did Bob Lambert do this? And was he authorised to do this? That's a key question, actually. I mean, Bob Lambert, it could be that the police, his handlers, knew all about it and said yes. In order to get close to the activists at the heart of the conspiracy, you've got to be part of it and actually do it. I mean, Jeff Shepherd says he never believed that Bob Lambert was an infiltrator. How could he be a police infiltrator? Because he himself had laid one of these incendiary devices, which had set fire and caused £300,000 worth of damage to a Debenhams store.
Yeah, he was complicit, allegedly.
So he convinced, Lambert convinced Jeff Shepherd so much by so much that he never thought that the police, again, it's a question of what the activists think the police would do. And that Jeff Shepherd said he never thought the police would go so far as to be complicit, allegedly, in this conspiracy. Therefore, you know, I mean, the ironic thing that happened in this case is that in the next wave, the first arson attack was in July 1987. A few months later, Jeff Shepherd and one of his other activists were in a room at Jeff Shepherd's home in Tottenham in a bedsit, and they were actually making the next round of incendiary devices, and they were literally caught red-handed one afternoon. Laid out in front of them were all the ingredients needed for another incendiary device. And suddenly through the door came the cops and arrested them.
Right at that moment.
Who would have thunk it? Who would have thought? Bob Lambert admits that he gave the tip-off, that he claims the credit for giving the tip-off, which enabled the police to catch Jeff Shepherd red-handed. But what is amazing about this story, I think, is that Jeff Shepherd had no inkling that Bob Lambert was actually a special branch officer, and that Bob Lambert came to visit Jeff Shepherd in prison.
Wrote him letters in prison as well.
And to go and support him. And Jeff sat there thinking, good old Bob, he's there to support me. When actually he was the guy who put him there. So for 24 years, again, until Lambert was unmasked, Jeff thought, you know,
Stand-up guy,
you know, he could never have been an infiltrator. So Lambert was very skilled at what he did.
There are a number of references in the book to British undercovers going abroad and collecting information on foreign activists and sharing them with foreign police forces. Did you discover much information about foreign spies operating here? For example, do you know whether they routinely shared information with UK police forces?
Yeah, this is another thing that's interesting, actually, because until Mark Kennedy came out and we started looking at what Mark Kennedy was doing, is that it became evident that Mark Kennedy was a sort of international spy in a way. He did a lot of foreign travel, and you know, the number of countries he went to is, you know, at least 11. Kennedy says it's 22, but he clearly went abroad a lot. And what's interesting here is that why was he doing that? And the question is, you know, in places, Kennedy went to Germany, Iceland, Denmark, all these places. And the question is, Kennedy was clearly embedded very effectively in a lot of environmental networks across Europe. You know, he had the because he was around for so long, he had the credibility to turn up at, you know,
youth house in Copenhagen.
Or, yeah,
just for example.
Yeah, yeah, the youth house, for example. That's a very interesting question, actually. You know, he had the credibility to turn up, and people wouldn't say, "Oh, who's he?" You know, he could say, "Oh, well," he could say, "X knows me," or whatever. But the question is, why was he there? Is it because the police in that country don't know, don't have the infiltrators themselves to go and get the information they want, so they call in someone else, you know, someone like Kennedy from another country? It's difficult to know, really. A lot of that question, a lot of questions have been asked about all of that, you know, mechanism, as it were. But you know, the respective governments have not really told, given the full answer.
Okay.
In the book, you mentioned Mark Kennedy being filmed having sex with a fellow activist aboard his narrow boat. Is this the only example you came across of covert video recording?
Yeah, I'm not absolutely sure that that's actually true.
Okay.
That was a story that was leaked to the press by the by the police.
Okay.
Quite a lurid story. Whether or not it's true, I don't know. I mean, we've written about it just to mention that this is what, you know, came out. But what is the question, that whether or not there's been covert...
Yeah, video footage.
Of activists. Captured.
I suppose specifically of that nature, of the most sort of private, personal nature.
Oh, no, I don't... No, I don't know of that.
Okay.
Okay. Next question then.
I mean, it could have happened, but I just don't know.
It's not come out yet. Did Mark Kennedy tell you why he wouldn't give you an interview? If you can reveal that. Sorry.
Yeah.
Did he want some money? Is that what it was?
I mean, to be frank, it's difficult to know what Mark Kennedy's motivations were. I mean, there was a period where we were in contact, and then since then, all the contact has stopped.
Okay.
But he, I think at that stage, I mean, Mark Kennedy, it's difficult to know what exactly is, you know, what his motivations are. So, you know, I think it's difficult to know exactly why he, whether or not he would have talked to us.
Did you hear any of the recordings made during Kennedy's initial unmasking by activists in Nottingham?
No, but I don't think it was recorded.
Oh. The phone call with the lecturer?
Oh, yes, yes, bit... sorry, yes, yes. I mean, yeah, sorry. That, yes, we have heard them.
That was a very clever move of the lecturer to record them, because they proved quite handy.
Yes, it was a very clever move. Yeah. Yeah, but a lot of the activists have got a lot of cunning, and they, you know, they do this thing, and you know, it's very convincing evidence. Mm. I mean, that is a problem for the police, that they are infiltrating movements full of people who are very switched on.
Yeah,
and you know. If the police are infiltrating undercover gangs, you know, involved... police are infiltrating gangs, serious crime gangs, you know, drug dealers, that type of thing, the level of contact between their undercover officer and the criminals is very, you know, is much, much smaller. So, in a sense, you know, the targets don't get to know their undercover officer, you know, half as much, anywhere near as much, as in if they're infiltrating a political group for, you know, 5 years, where they, you know, they drink together, they're together, you know, they, well, as Mark Kennedy did, you know, he slept with them. So the campaigners, you know, often they have quite a good antennae about people who they think are suspicious.
Had a very, very thorough grilling. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rob Evans, for your time. You've been listening to The Circle Day on Resonance 104.4 FM. Till next week, turn on, tune in and kick off.
the peanuts that the parties have tossed you. In the backseat of your father's new Ford, you believe in the ballot, you believe in reform, you have faith in the elephant and jackass.